Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It will be a day of economic indicators on this particular radio program. Chinese gross domestic product. How many people in this country have to hold down more than one job to get by? And also, pawn shops. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 15th of July. Good as always to have you with us. I'm going to guess the name Fabrice Tour doesn't really ring a bell, but there is a chance you remember him as Fabulous Fab in a deal he did while he was working at Goldman Sachs called Abacus. The Securities and Exchange Commission sued Goldman and Tour, saying they sold subprime mortgage investments they expected to fail. Oh, and they did fail spectacularly. Goldman settled for $550 million. Tour decided to fight to clear his name, and his trial started today. He's all alone, with no senior bankers from Goldman by his side. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on why the little guys might wind up paying big for financial crisis misdeeds.
As fabulous as Fabrice Tour may have been, he was small potatoes at Goldman Sachs, says Joe Grunfest, a former commissioner of the SEC.
One of the questions the jury is likely to have is, why is it that the SEC is prosecuting somebody who's of such relatively low rank for what's claimed to be such a major fraud and violation?
It's often hard to link senior executives to specific products, says James Cox, a professor of securities law at Duke. He says the higher-ups usually aren't directly involved in trades. They may know about them, but that's harder to prove.
It's pretty easy to isolate the salesman's involvement. Then when you start going into how it all got assembled and who knew what when, it becomes fuzzier.
And a whole lot more expensive to fight, says Cox, because companies will pull out their legal A-teams to protect the people in the C-suites.
If you start going after senior-level individuals, you have got the tiger by the tail.
Securities attorney Lance Kimmel says the SEC needs a win, especially since it lost a similar case against two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers in 2009.
This may give the SEC their first case victory for people that they allege showed this extreme arrogance in the years leading up to the financial crisis.
In other words, says Kimmel, even though justice may not be wholly served, the SEC may just want to fight the fight it can win. Fabulous Fab maintains he did nothing wrong. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
In the hours before Wall Street opened this morning, there was one economic number everybody was wanting to see. Chinese gross domestic product came out today. It seems the world's second largest economy is growing at an annual rate of 7.5%. That's down a couple of decimal points from last quarter. Not, however, as bad as many feared. But seriously, who are we kidding anyway? Most economists figure China fudges its economic numbers anyhow. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz tries to get at the truth.
First lesson about China's GDP growth figure, it's an impenetrable black box, says economist Patrick Shavonik.
There's no way that you can get behind the numbers and actually figure out where they came from.
Well, there is a way if you're among China's ruling elite. According to a 2007 U.S. diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks, current Premier Li Keqiang told the U.S. ambassador that China's GDP figures were man-made. Li is now in charge of China's economy. Li told the ambassador the way he figured out China's GDP growth was to look at electricity consumption, rail cargo volume, and bank lending numbers. This magical formula was later dubbed the Li Keqiang Index.
If you go by the Li Keqiang Index, the Chinese economy right now has fallen below the low point that it hit in early 2009 in the wake of the global financial crisis.
That would put China's current GDP growth at least a percentage point lower than what the government says it is. Beijing-based economist Michael Pettis says it doesn't matter. He says China's GDP data is supposed to measure economic activity.
So if you build an empty airport...
For the record, China's built dozens of them.
That shows up as an increase in economic activity, but it's not really an increase in wealth if nobody uses the airport.
And that's why, as Premier Li said with a smile in what he thought was a confidential conversation in 2007, China's GDP numbers are for reference only. in Shanghai. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Here's your Wall Street reference. The major indices were up a tetch to start the week. I think that's a technical term. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are a lot of things about the American labor market that are different than they were 5 years ago. Stubbornly high unemployment you know about, an unhealthy rise in long-term joblessness as well. And then this puzzler. Since the beginning of the Great Recession, the number of people stuck working part-time because they can't get full-time jobs is way up. But at the same time, there's been a sharp drop in the number of people holding down multiple jobs. So, to lay it all out here, more people in part-time jobs, but fewer people able to cobble together a couple of three of those jobs to make ends meet. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
The first part of this economic conundrum, can we call it an econundrum? I don't know. It's pretty straightforward. It's the recession. Jobs are still hard to find. Well-paying full-time jobs, harder still.
I'm used to working 3 to 4 jobs historically. Because I never seem to work jobs that pay me any money, so I need to work a lot of them.
Justine Pope of Portland was eating her bagged lunch at a downtown park recently. She's 27. Count back to the late 2000s when she graduated college, she's pretty much never seen a healthy job market.
I farmed, I waitressed, I landscaped, and I nannied. I never earned more than $18,000 in a year. I know it's shocking. So I feel like I'm doing okay now.
Okay, because she's found two jobs, legal assistant and research assistant, each 20 hours, and they're just paying the bills. This trend to more part-time work could be permanent. Employers like the flexibility and the cost. Benefits are slim to none. But here's the complication. For job seekers, it's now harder to find and keep multiple part-time jobs.
Among the low-wage employers, retail, hospitality, food service, employers are requiring their employees to say that they're available for a full-time schedule, even when they know they're never going to schedule them for full-time.
Stephanie Luce is a labor sociologist at the City University of New York who's studied the retail industry.
Managers are asked to schedule based on customer flow, based on weather, based on trends in the economy, to change the schedule day to day. They don't want employees that are going to say, I can't come in, I have another job. They want employees that will say, okay, I'll come in if you need me.
Hello, I'll take your order if you're ready.
You don't have to go further than the nearest fast food joint to see this trend.
Yeah, I'm mostly just in the drive-thru in front counter.
Devontae Yates works at a McDonald's in Milwaukee. He lives with his mom. I reached him on his cell phone as he was heading out to the bus for his hour-and-a-half ride to work. Yates is getting his associate's degree, so he's paying tuition plus rent to his mom and helping with the groceries on minimum wage, $7.25 an hour.
The schedule comes out Friday. However, it is subject to change. Sometimes you can work a 1 to 9, and then the very next day have to be back at 6 in the morning. So they schedule you so randomly that it's pretty much impossible to find another job.
The 24-hour McDonald's where Yates works expects its employees to offer open availability, basically be on call all the time. Sometimes it's a 2-hour shift, sometimes 8. There's management speak for this, says Luce. Just-in-time scheduling.
In fact, I was just reading a retail consulting report that said this was the main area in which businesses could achieve profit, was using labor scheduling technologies. Employers want to reduce their cost. It was excess inventory in the 90s, and now it's excess employment.
And remember Justine Pope? While she likes the variety of having so many jobs, she's tired of having so many jobs.
I'll say I know my situation is certainly not sustainable long term. I would hope to not work so many jobs or so hard my entire life.
Thing is, she just might. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I Quick and easy has become a veritable staple of the American diet. Mom and or dad get home from work and they've got to get something on the table. For decades now, one of the big names in that sector has been Hamburger Helper. It's been popular since the 1970s, but General Mills is going after a new audience. They're getting going on Facebook and Twitter, and they're rebranding, cutting out the hamburger. Vanessa Wong wrote about it in Bloomberg Business Week. Vanessa, it's good to have you here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I will confess that my first thought when I read your article was, wait, they still make Hamburger Helper?
I think a lot of people have that response. It's a pretty old brand. It's 42 years old this year. It was founded in 1971. And General Mills is looking for a way to freshen it up.
And they've decided to do that by dropping the hamburger from Hamburger Helper? What's up with that?
Exactly. So Hamburger Helper is no longer Hamburger Helper. It's just Helper.
Because why? Because they want people to use chicken and, I don't know, pork and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, so they've had other varieties, right? There's tuna helper.
Yeah.
There's chicken helper. But everyone identifies the brand as Hamburger Helper. That's how it launched. So today, chicken's the more popular protein.
Yeah, of course.
And they decided that hamburger was, you know, maybe it felt a little bit outdated. It was limiting the brand.
Who buys this? Is it working moms? Is it singles? I mean, who buys it?
Today, working moms are still their core demographic.
Mm-hmm.
However, they found that lots of young men are also eating Helper.
Really?
Right. So half of the people who are talking about Helper on Twitter are young men.
Have you, in the course of reporting this article, did you wind up cooking a lot of Hamburger Helper?
I did. I just made some Hamburger Helper the other night, actually.
And how was it? I mean, how did it taste? I confess I've never tried it.
So I haven't had Helper in a really long time.
Like, you've even bought into
I've
it.
Never
you're
made
it. You're calling it Helper. You've even bought into the whole thing.
I've got it. I'm trying to be accurate now. So basically, the brand tries to be an easy-to-make, affordable meal for busy people.
Right.
So I went to the grocery store. I bought a box of Helper, a pound of meat, and a quart of milk, which is basically all you need. And you need a cup of water.
God,
right.
Ew.
For my recipe, I made the cheeseburger whole wheat Helper. And
it just sounds so
unappetizing. And then it sits in about 3 cups of liquid, 2 cups of milk, 1 cup of water, and then it boils down. And at the end, you have a cheesy, meaty noodle dish. And it took 37 minutes.
$8 in a half an hour.
Well, you know, the funny thing is my husband said, I think we should have just made a frozen pizza.
Right. Exactly. Is this actually going to work, do you think? Are they going to, I mean, they're in a, you know, General Mills says they're in 1 million households now. Are they going to get, you know, 1.5 million, 2 million out of this?
Right. Well, that's what they say. They say that about 1 million households are eating Hamburger Helper every weeknight.
So that's extraordinary.
That's a lot of Helper. Yeah. The thing is that they have competitors now. So in the 12 months ending in mid-May, their sales, General Mills sales in the dry dinner mix category was down 14%.
Say that again. Dry dinner mix category? Come on.
Yes. Yes.
That's right. Vanessa Wong at Bloomberg Business Week. Vanessa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
pawn shops do well in most every economy. We loan more money in the downturn. We sell more merchandise in the upside economies.
So how are they doing now? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials began the week quietly, added 19 points the blue chips did, a 10%, closed at 15,484. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 0.2%, finished at 3607. The S&P 500 notched up 2 points, a 0.1% there. Finished at 1682. Leap Wireless International, the fifth largest wireless network in the United States, which is to say a small-ish network, saw its shares double after AT&T agreed to buy it. AT&T slipped a 0.5%, rival Verizon off 0.9% today. Boeing had a bad day Friday, you might recall, after one of its new 787s caught fire at Heathrow Airport in London. Soared 3.75 points today after UK regulators found no link to the battery problems that grounded the model earlier. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a look at what consumers paid for goods and services in June. Was it more or less than in May? The Labor Department releases its monthly consumer price index. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And on July 16, 1951, J.D. Salinger's novel, The Catcher in the Rye, was published. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. At an age when most have long since retired, 83-year-old Arthur Frommer is getting back in the publishing business. Less than a year after his eponymous travel guidebooks were sold to Google, Frommer has bought his brand back. Gutsy move, don't you think, when the internet has made travel planning basically free? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Websites like Yelp and TripAdvisor give away their travel reviews. Peter Hildick-Smith is CEO at Codex Group, which researches trends in the publishing industry. He says modern vagabonds don't lug around heavy guidebooks.
My son just graduated from college, is now traveling in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. His smartphone is his travel guide.
There's no doubt that many sites on the web are eating into the business of the traditional travel guides, but that doesn't mean we don't have a place.
That's Pauline Frommer, co-president of Frommer Media. She says what distinguishes the company is expert, unbiased advice. By contrast, a hotel review on a travel website might not have been written by a real customer.
A lot of those reviews are sheer, unadulterated marketing. I've had hoteliers and hotel chain executives tell me they have people working full-time posting fake reviews.
Frommer's remains a trusted name. Again, Peter Hildick-Smith.
The Frommer's brand is, from our research, probably the biggest and strongest brand in the whole guidebook business in the United States.
Will brand recognition translate into sales? Frommer's will find out this fall when it rolls out a series of shorter books called Easy Guides. But Pauline Frommer says the company won't stop with print.
We're not married to paper books. We are married to journalistically created travel information.
For those travelers who only pack a smartphone for their journey, Frommer's will offer apps and ebooks too. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
These are difficult days for what used to be the fairly straightforward subject of internships, the unpaid kind in particular. Former interns have been suing big companies. NBC is just the latest, saying they never got the educational experience they were promised, which isn't really ideal since they were getting college credit for these internships. In other cases, former interns claimed they did the same work regular employees did, except, you know, for free, all of which makes for management headaches, as Sally Herships reports.
Recently, I sent out a tweet which said, "Don't throw anything at the screen, but any unpaid interns out there who feel like it's worth it?"
I couldn't be more grateful to have had the experience. You know, a classroom education only goes so far.
Arielle Rosenfeld sent one of the many replies I got. She's 25 and works in development for the Giva Theater Center in Rochester, New York. That's where she started as a college junior doing an unpaid internship.
Well, I feel like I was paid in a way. I was paid with the knowledge that I would not have received otherwise.
Rosenfeld helped with research, organizing files, and running auditions. She says what she learned about running a theater, she wouldn't have picked up in a classroom.
What all the rules are in actor's equity and how that pertains to the rehearsal time and how the stage manager keeps a really clear clock of how, you know, everything is timed out to the minute.
And timing worked out for Rosenfeld. She was hired right out of college. But when a student is doing an internship, there's no way to know if it'll end up paying off later with a paycheck or not. Rosenfeld's situation is ideal, but not all interns are equally happy.
It's been done for years, and I think when these cases started dropping, people were just shocked. And now the world's waking up a little bit and saying, well, I'm not sure this is right.
John Israel is a lawyer who specializes in labor and employment. He's talking about all those lawsuits where unpaid interns are suing. NBC, Fox Searchlight Pictures, Condé Nast, Outen and Golden, the law firm behind all of those cases, says interns are not supposed to do the same work as regular employees, and they're not allowed to do work that will immediately benefit a company. But isn't real work the best kind of experience? The law firm says while it may be great, it's also work and needs to be paid for. Peter Capelli directs Wharton Center for Human Resources.
If the intern is doing work that benefits me, why shouldn't I be willing to pay them something for it?
Capelli says nonprofits like museums and public radio shows are allowed to hire unpaid interns. But unless students are getting college credit and learning something, companies have to pay. And what about the argument that an unpaid internship is a lot cheaper than tuition for graduate school?
If you think about the choice, either paying a ton of money or doing it for nothing, that sounds great. But if you think of the choice as being doing it for nothing versus doing it and getting paid for it, it doesn't sound so great.
It's never clear-cut like that. Nothing's that simple.
Paul Oyer teaches economics at Stanford. What about the argument that unpaid internships are unfair because only the wealthy can afford them?
Yeah, there's some unfairness to that.
But Oyer says destroying the whole institution as a result seems a little extreme. Besides, employers want to see internships on resumes. John Israel, the labor lawyer, says he did an unpaid internship and it was valuable.
I'm sure there are very unpleasant, exploitative unpaid internships, and it would be nice to get rid of those. Unfortunately, I don't know a way to do that without getting rid of a lot of very valuable unpaid internships.
And they are. I mean, that's the reality. I'd say, look, my value to the business during that time period, probably not much, okay? I'm not sure what I added, but, you know, to see those things go away because businesses won't be able to afford the risk of creating that opportunity, I think that's a shame.
In the meantime, Arielle Rosenfeld is working with interns at the Giva Theater Center. And just like when she was an intern, they're also not paid. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We measure the health of the American economy all kinds of ways on this program. New housing starts, gross domestic product, retail, and unemployment. Also, pawn shops. Cash America, the biggest pawn shop company in this country, said today profits probably won't be as good as everybody's expecting. Is it the rising economy or general consumer confidence? Something the Fed is doing with interest rates? I don't know. Michael Mack is the owner of Mack's Pawn in Las Vegas, Nevada. Mike, it's good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Let me test a premise here with you. The conventional wisdom is that when the economy is doing well, pawn shops don't, and vice versa. First of all, is that true?
No, not necessarily. Pawn shops do well in most every economy. We loan more money in the downturn. We sell more merchandise in the upside economies. So, you know, we try to hedge ourselves both ways.
So what do you see coming in the door nowadays?
Well, you know, the demand for loans is still there. We are not seeing the higher end demand. We mainly cater to the lower and middle class. And since the big crunch, we've seen a lot more higher end clientele on the lending side. People that, you know, normally would use traditional banking sources that, you know, if they needed a $10,000 or $20,000 loan to pay their property tax or their private schooling or...
You see people coming in pawning $10,000 worth of stuff?
You know, we've seen some big collateral automobiles. We've taken in some planes over the years. We've taken a lot of crazy items over the years. I'm a fourth-generation pawnbroker.
Do you, every time you take one of those crazy items, do you kind of cross your fingers and go, all right, man, I hope this works out?
You know, that's the difference between, I think, the new age pawnbroker and the old school pawnbroker. The old pawnbroker was happy when that asset fell out so he could make a score and make a big retail. But our asset really is the client. We want the customer to come back, pick up their collateral, and hopefully use us again for another type of loan.
Do you in Las Vegas see different things than people in New York City and Atlanta and wherever?
Well, you know, it's all based on the interest rates. When you raise the interest rates too high, you lose a bigger and bigger market share of your loan customer. I think Nevada has a fair rate, and we in Las Vegas are a 24/7 town, so we have a higher demand for cash.
Yeah.
But we do have some of the best pawn shops in the U.S. right here in Las Vegas.
Just hearing you mention interest rates, are you paying a lot of attention to what Ben Bernanke and the Fed are doing?
We sure are.
Are you really? That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'd like to borrow from traditional banking sources as well. And so if Bernanke raises rates, we're going to be affected by those rate changes as well.
When big companies like Cash America say that their growth has slowed, that they're going to report lower than expected profits, does that trickle down to you, the owner-operator of your own store, or is it that are they having their own corporate problems?
Well, you know, Cash America is a fine-run company. I would never discount what's happening there. I believe that a lot of their effect has been the price of gold. A lot of the big public companies, as well as myself, have depended on that gold rush, and where people were selling gold off, you know, at a high price. You know, gold's taken a big dip, of course, this year. Mm-hmm. That easy business of taking gold, refining it, making money, making a profit margin is over.
I imagine when you need some spare cash, you don't wind up going to a pawn shop, do you?
Well, if I did, I know where to go.
Michael Mack is the owner of Mack's Pawn in Las Vegas. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial is less than 48 hours old and the selling has already begun. The first potential book deal has been announced. Juror B37, one of six women on that panel that acquitted Zimmerman Saturday night, has signed with a book agent. Just to complete the circle of commercialization and media coverage of this case, it seems the juror was referred to the agent by a producer at one of the morning news shows. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 19 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 2 points. That's a 10%. Our producers include Bridget Bonner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.